The remote hearing of the Capital Investment Committee for April 21st is called to order. This remote hearing is taking place in accordance with House Rule 10.01. It's being live streamed by the House Public Information Office. Mr. Wilcox, please take the roll.
Chair Lee.
Lee present.
Lee present. Vice Chair Murphy.
Murphy present.
Murphy present. Representative Erdahl.
I'm here.
Erdahl present. Representative Igbajit.
Present.
Igbajit present. Representative Berg.
Present.
Berg present. Representative Davids.
Davids present.
Davids present. Representative Frankie.
Frankie present.
Frankie present. Representative Freiberg.
Present.
Freiberg present. Representative Hansen.
Present.
Hansen present. Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Hewitt present. Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Lilly present. Representative Lucero.
Good morning.
Lucero present. Representative Moran. Excuse. Representative Pearson.
Pearson present.
Pearson present. Representative Raleigh.
Raleigh present.
Raleigh present. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Rasmussen present. Representative Ryer.
Ryer present.
Ryer present. Representative West.
West present.
West present. And Representative Zhang. Representative Zhang. All right, Mr. Chair, we do have a quorum.
Quorum, Ms. President. Chair Murphy, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for Tuesday, April 19th?
I move approval of the minutes for Tuesday, April 19th as printed.
Chair Murphy moves approval of the minutes for Tuesday, April 19th. Any discussions? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. The minutes for Tuesday, April 19th are approved. Members, today we will continue to hear bills on informational hearings, bill hearing only with amendments offered for reference. There will be six bills on the agenda, and the first one is House File 4628. Chair Daphne, please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 4628 before the Capital Investment Committee. This bill appropriates over $110 million from the Coronavirus Capital Projects Fund for digital connectivity technology projects and multipurpose community facilities. The money is appropriated from two pools. Those pools are united by an emphasis on digital connectivity for work, school, and health monitoring. More specifically, Mr. Chair, $40 million of the appropriation is for grants to local governments, nonprofit organizations, and private entities for the purchase and or installation of devices and equipment, while the remaining $70,703,000 of the appropriation is again for grants to local governments, nonprofits, and private entities, but this time for multipurpose community facilities that enable work, education, and health monitoring for members of the public. The bill prioritizes serving historically underserved communities, communities that do not have access to these resources, to areas where there are issues of access below performance standards, and that incorporates strong labor standards to assure high-quality projects while averting costly and disruptive delays. With me today, Mr. Chair, as you know, I have the privilege of having two testifiers from different parts of the state exploring different facets of the bill and what it could mean for communities statewide. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Daphne. First on the agenda, we have Mr. Williams. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Jim Philby Williams. I lead the Duluth Public Library for the City of Duluth. I'm here to testify in support of House File 4628, through which the state of Minnesota would, for the first time, invest in the enhancement of multipurpose community facilities, including public libraries, at a scale that matches the need. Constructing or renovating a multipurpose community facility, such as a library, to simultaneously meet education, work, and health needs is expensive. A multipurpose library serving a small to medium-sized community might cost $5 to $10 million to construct or renovate. A facility serving a large community might cost $20 to $60 million. The state of Minnesota's existing library construction grant program has a budget of $3 million per year for the entire state. In contrast, House File 4628 would distribute $110 million of federal funds in just the next year or two, enough to make transformational improvements to multipurpose community facilities across the state. Facilities like the City of Duluth's nearly 50-year-old main library. The city's advancing a project to renovate the deteriorating 75,000-square-foot building to house and integrate not only the main branch of our regional library system, but also the primary site for our regional interagency workforce development center and an array of nonprofit-supported health information services. When complete, the building will include large multipurpose computer labs, connectivity hubs, and connected meeting rooms that will support an array of integrated services, from workforce development counseling and digital literacy training to early learning programming and assistance accessing health insurance. Located in a diverse, low-income urban neighborhood, the new facility will be a radically inclusive place where Duluth area residents who were most heavily impacted by the pandemic will be able to access the education, work, and health information all of us need to live well in a challenging and rapidly changing world. House File 4628 can bring this project and others like it within financial reach of cities across Minnesota, large and small. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. The City of Duluth encourages your strong support of House File 4628.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Next on the agenda, we have Ms. Pankart. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Catherine Pankart, and I am director of St. Paul Public Library and also a resident of St. Paul. I am here to testify in strong support of House File 4628. The COVID-19 pandemic illuminated the extent to which many residents of Minnesota are not connected to affordable, high-quality broadband in their homes, do not have access to the types of technology devices needed to fully participate in education, work, and health monitoring, and rely upon support to navigate the digital world as the nature of education, work, and healthcare move more online. Public libraries play an essential role in providing access to technology, equipment, support, and resources that enable all people to fully participate in our society. In St. Paul, our libraries collaborate with key community partners to make resources and supports extremely accessible to people. We work with Ramsey County Workforce to provide tailored support for job seekers, people in career transition, and people with digital equity needs. We are working with the University of St. Thomas Morrison Family College of Health to develop a new model that will bring basic health support to community locations by hosting nursing students in our public libraries. As a public library system serving the BIPOC majority city of St. Paul, we have dynamic partnerships and programming in place to help meet the needs of our community. The missing piece, the piece we cannot get on our own, is physical spaces that meet today's standards of technology-rich community facilities. As an example, Hayden Heights Library on the Greater East Side of St. Paul has the potential to be a dynamic 21st century community resource hub. Hayden Heights Library serves one of our city's most diverse neighborhoods by race, income, and education. Nearly 60% of residents are Black, Indigenous, or people of color. 46% speak a language other than English. This neighborhood that represents the global majority is also an area of our city that will be growing over the next decade. The library that serves this neighborhood has not been updated in more than 40 years. There was no way that its last major renovation in 1979 anticipated the digital and social connection needs of today's library users. The Coronavirus Capital Projects Fund would enable transformative capital investment in libraries like Hayden Heights to create vibrant, welcoming, technology-rich community resource hubs that bring services and support directly to neighbors in radically accessible ways. Multi-use community facilities play an essential role in ensuring all people have access to technology resources and support to get their education, work, and health needs met. On behalf of St. Paul Public Library, the City of St. Paul, and the broader library community, I strongly support the proposed investments as part of advancing equity in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pankart. Now we'll turn to members' questions. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is not directed at anybody in particular, whoever wants to answer. Could one of the testifiers or the bill author just give more clarity or more example what is meant by health information services as part of this bill? The only reference I heard in the testifiers was something to the effect of nursing students was going to be at one of the facilities, but I'm just looking for more information on what health information services means as part of this bill.
Chair Daphne or one of your testifiers?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Plankert referenced that. Maybe she could expand on what the St. Paul Libraries is looking to deliver to the community in that partnership.
Ms. Plankert.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Lee and representatives. The guidance, the federal guidance for this funding source is very broad on the definition of community facilities that meet health monitoring needs. So per the federal guidance, a place in a community with a technology space like a computer where a community member could go to log on for a telehealth session, like a library, would meet the federal guidance. And then, yes, I referenced more specific partnerships we're developing here in St. Paul to really work with healthcare partners like University of St. Thomas as they develop a new nursing program that will create more nurses for the state of Minnesota and integrating nursing students into our community locations, providing basic public health support as part of their nursing education program and as part of adding new ways for community members to access basic health support in places and in locations that work for them.
Thank you, Ms. Pekar. Real quickly, before you go, Representative Lucero, I do want to note that in your package from the committee, we do have the guidance for you to review if you so choose. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the next question I would have is I was listening, I was hearing several examples of workforce development, career development, along those lines. And so to the bill author, I suppose, or either the testifiers, rather than take, and I'm just trying to think as these dollars, as options that are available to us with finite amounts of dollars and allowing them to go as far as possible, would it potentially make better sense, rather than taking buildings that are 50 years out of date and bringing them up to date, to harness the buildings we already have that are in the business of career development, et cetera, such as the many Minsky college campuses we have that are perhaps not 50 years out of date, that maybe have more of the technology already in them, and would be a much less delta to bring them up to in alignment with whatever the objective is here. Couldn't we better use some of the other buildings and other facilities that we have in the state rather than taking new spaces and radically transforming them?
Chair Dudley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lucero, I think it's a both and. I think it's a matter of looking at what buildings are there, what buildings can be best adapted to modern technology needs. I think both Mr. Williams and Ms. Pankert spoke to that and the need to upgrade buildings. And frankly, I think we also know on our community college campuses, there's often needs to update buildings to better meet modern needs. So I think it's both and, not either or.
Thank you for that, Chair Daphne. And members, I'd like to point you all to page 10 and 11 of the guidance where they said that projects costs are not limited to new construction. For example, project costs can involve improvements and repairs to buildings to permit the buildings to be used for the eligible purposes of education, workforce, and health monitoring. Any additional
questions? Mr. Chair, I'd also like to focus the committee that the purpose of these funds is to take down barriers for access to work so that individuals can join the workforce or join the workforce at a higher level because they've gotten access to additional skills. And at this point in our state, when workforce is such an issue, our unemployment rate is so low and our employers' needs are so high for new employees, taking down barriers that have limited some people's access to the workforce needs to be an important strategy for the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Daphne and testifiers. Members, this was heard on an informational basis only. Really appreciate you coming by, Chair Daphne.
Next, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Next on the agenda is House File 4631, which is my bill, so I'll turn it over to Chair Murphy. Chair Murphy, you're muted.
Okay. Representative Lee, would you please introduce your bill and tell us all about it?
Thank you, Chair Murphy, and thank you, committee. So I do have the DE2 amendment for all of you to reference. The amendment adds how future weather trends can be integrated into the design and evaluations of buildings and how future weather trends may impact our natural systems and the need for infrastructure to maintain and increase our food and wood production, reduction of fire risk on forested land, and maintain and enhance our water quality and maintain our natural habitats. And so members, I think that bringing this bill forward for all of us to have a discussions because of some of the issues that we have seen as we toured the entire state over the last few years for the Capital Investment Committee. I think for me in particular, I have noticed how extreme weather trends such as increase of precipitation have resulted in more requests for state infrastructure funding. Back in 2019, when I served as the vice chair for Chair Murphy, I think one thing that really stood out for me, and you know, we had a brief conversation around this already, was around flood hazard mitigation. You know, there's been an increased request for flood hazard mitigation because of some of the increased rainfall that one of our presenters will talk about. And what really got to me was when I asked nonpartisan fiscal staff about state spending on just flood hazard in the Red River Basin, and you know, to provide you all perspective, from 1997 to 2018, the state share of flood hazard mitigation totaled $368 million. And this is quite alarming for me, and so I think that it is crucial for us to really think about, you know, how is future weather trends going to impact and exacerbate conditions such as drought, elevated temperatures, and flooding that can be integrated into how we design and evaluate building construction in the state of Minnesota. And so with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to my testifier.
Before that, Chair Lee, do you want to amend the bill with the DE2?
So yeah, Madam Chair, I did go over the DE2 amendment. And since we are hearing this informationally, we don't have to vote on it. I have presented on the DE2 amendment.
Okay. So it's House File 4631, DE2.
Yes.
That we're talking about. And welcome, Dr. Richard Graves.
Thank you. And can I share my screen? Let's see.
Yes.
There we go. So my name is Richard Graves, and I am the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the College of Design and a fellow at the Institute on the Environment at the University of Minnesota. Thank you, Chair Lee and members of the committee, for inviting me here today to talk about the impact of a changing climate in Minnesota and research needed to understand those impacts and integrate that understanding at different scales in a dynamic future. I applaud the committee for the foresight to understand the dynamic future public infrastructure needs to operate within to provide buildings, energy, water, and other services to support our quality of life and a strong economy in Minnesota. Substantial warming during winter and at night, increased precipitation and heavier downpours already have affected our natural resources and how we interact with and use them. The decades ahead will bring even warmer winters and nights and even larger rainfalls, along with the likelihood of increased summer heat and the potential for longer, drier spells in the summer. Minnesota has warmed 3 degrees Fahrenheit between 1895 and 2020, with annual precipitation increased by an average of 3.4 inches. Although Minnesota has gotten warmer and wetter since 1895, the most dramatic changes have come in the past several decades. Compared to 20th century averages, all but 2 years since 1970 have been warm, wet, or both. And each of the top 10 combined warmest and wettest years on record occurred between 1998 and 2020. Although climate conditions will vary from year to year, these increases are expected to continue into the 21st century. More intense rainstorms are putting stress on stormwater infrastructure designed for historic rain events instead of anticipating the future and the changing climate. This infrastructure operates at a variety of scales, from buildings to roads, from lots to neighborhoods to cities to watersheds. localized flooding impacts could be as significant as river and waterway flooding in the future and should be considered in design. In addition, river flooding and the location of water and wastewater infrastructure has caused disruption in the last 10 years and should also be addressed in the design and operation of those facilities. My center studied the impact of a changing climate on design decisions for the built environment in a study for the MPCA in 2018. And part of that study used future climate files to compare historic weather data for energy design models for an apartment building and library buildings. Even the best weather files are at best 15 years old and at worst 27 years old in their data. Morphing methodology includes additive shift and multiplicative shifts based on the type of data, and that data needs to be updated for future climate forecasts. So needed research in this area is focusing on and applying new and emerging downscaled climate data to Minnesota. We also need to model the impact of a changing climate to energy efficiency and design. Energy models we're using are for historic data and may miss cost-effective strategies for a changing climate going forward. We also need to understand the impact of a changing climate on site and water design to increase resilience, and then also assess additional risks and impacts and develop the role of infrastructure that can play to reduce those impacts. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Dr. Graves, and thank you, Chair Lee. And we will now move on to your next bill, for House File 4231. And
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I have my hand up for testifier on this bill.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question for the testifier is, in your testimony, you had mentioned, you referenced since 1895 that temperatures in Minnesota had risen 3 degrees Fahrenheit on average. My question is, why are you going from 1895 forward? Do you have any research that shows how much the temperature in Minnesota rose prior to 1895? Like the ice age, because we're no longer in an ice age, and we can see the impacts of the ice age in the geological formations across Minnesota. So what does your research show about the rise in temperature prior to 1895?
Dr. Graves.
The 1895 is used because that's the date where we can go back to recorded weather, consistent and recorded weather data in Minnesota. So that's the use of 1895 in the weather data, which is the source of weather data we use in kind of the designing the built environment. Weather data before that would be outside of my expertise.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, well then, if the data that is used, the data site is only going back to 1895, that is just a drop in the bucket for the entirety of a global weather history. How can, you had referenced that you were building or seeking to build future models to help create understanding for climate resiliency. How is it even possible to even consider building models with such a tiny fraction sliver of the data set if only going back to 1895?
Dr. Graves.
Well, so 2 points. One is, you know, I agree with you that historic data isn't a good basis for designing buildings that will be inhabited in the future. And the question is, and I think the research is needed to what is a reasonable set of forward-looking data that's more accurate, more useful for designers and owners of buildings to operate and design, create design strategies for buildings in the near future, in the lifespan, you know, of the building they're designing.
one last comment, Ms. Madam Chair.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, and I agree. Going forward, to try to understand, but to if we use past as a predictor of the future, we have to expand way more than 1895, because clearly the globe has warmed radically thousands of years ago to be in a condition where the ice age melted. So I think it's, you know, on the heels here of data modeling attempting to explain COVID and how they were radically wrong. It's great concern to me to attempt to use modeling to predict future weather when we're using just a sliver of data set. So thank you, Madam Chair. I just have great concerns regarding this conversation.
Thank you very much. Representative Erdl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Graves. Piggybacking a little bit with Representative Lucero, certainly there have been changes in our weather, in our climate over the years. And prior to, I guess, 1895, do we have any other historical precedents on how we deal with change in our climate and weather? Mr. Graves.
Dr. Graves.
Yeah, historic precedents within the built environment.
Just, you know, through history, how has there been concerns about change in climate and weather? Have there been any precedents, I guess, for past scientists or people concerned about this and how to deal with it? Because the change isn't new. Maybe it's accelerating. I don't know. But it's we're now trying to figure out how we're going to deal with these things. I'm just wondering if in the past there was any type of movement like that, type of any precedents for how to deal with climate change or weather change.
I don't have the answer to that question. I think the significance and the regularity of consistent change that we're seeing over the last 20 years is different than kind of a longer history of droughts that may come and go or cold winters that may come and go. And so that has sort of caused the investment in sort of research and focusing on, are there longer term trends other than, you know, periodic changes that we need to be shifting our thinking around in terms of the weather data and other data we're using to kind of inform smart design decisions.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Graves, Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. I'll just say that I appreciate what you're talking about, but I also share a lot of the concerns that Representative Lucero has in how this has been dealt with and the perspective of the past. Thank you.
Representative Lee, Mr. Chair, would you, with this study that's going on and this trend integration from this research that Dr. Graves will do, will the legislator get a legislature get a report back on the findings?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the bill does require a report by February 1st, 2025 to the committees with jurisdiction over environment policy and capital investment, summarizing the findings and any recommendations that they may find in their research.
Okay, thank you. Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. Lee, for bringing this forward. I guess my question, and probably a little bit more of a comment, is, you know, it seems to me that this study is looking at best practices of how we can ensure that our structures and our infrastructure moving forward can sustain the various damage and extreme weather that we're now seeing, that we've seen over the years, that's been starting to be relatively consistent. So to me, I imagine this is kind of similar to how different regions of the country build in order to protect against tornadoes and other natural disasters. So I guess that's probably sort of my question, is that kind of the similar impetus behind this study and this work to make sure that we're building for the future and that we're knowing the types of changes that are coming into our region.
Dr. Graves.
Yes, Representative, that's exactly the focus. The focus is, are there shifts in the climate and shifts in the design requirements because of that changing climate that should be incorporated as best practice in design? And, you know, and part of that gets to cost effectiveness. Are we incorporating design elements based upon kind of colder, more intense winters, which we're not going to be seeing, and designing site requirements for old, outdated rainfall events when we should be shifting our design strategies to incorporating the influence of warmer summers and to mitigate what's the most cost-effective way to mitigate these more intense rainfall events. So I think you're exactly right. It gets to sort of best practice and what's the most best practice to incorporate these changes into the built environment.
Representative Bache.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Dr. Graves. I appreciate that. I just would add, I think that that's really important for us to look at because everything is changing around us and we just want to be prepared. So appreciate the testimony.
Thank you very much. Seeing no other hands, I will, Representative Lee, we will go on to your next bill. We will conclude with 4631. And go on to your next bill, House File 231. And I see Dr. Graves is here again, and Sherry Hansen, Director of Communications, Advocacy, and Public Outreach for AIA Minnesota. So, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. So, House File 4231 is a bill to require that no funds may be dispersed beyond final design until a recipient of state funding have an approval from the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota stating that they or the project design complies with our state sustainable building guidelines. As members may know, you know, this is a requirement for all state funding or, you know, major renovation in the state of Minnesota. The bill also removes the exemptions of park and ride facilities, water and wastewater facilities, and ice centers from being exempted from having a pre-designed plan. The bill also requires small construction projects to hire a qualified cost estimating professional as part of the planning process so that we could actually get an accurate figure of what's going to cost the state to fund a particular project that's coming before us. And the bill also requires the small construction limits to be increased and with inflation. These are information that, it's similar to some of the other proposals that we have at the legislature to make sure that it is indexed to the means quarterly construction cost index so that we could actually have an accurate cost and figure amount of what we need to fund at the state level when projects are coming before us. And so, In the bill, we also have a blank appropriations for the Center for Sustainable Building Research to help inform local governments and other recipients of state funds about the requirement under the Section 16B335 Subdivision 1, the design plans. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to the testifiers.
Okay. Dr. Graves?
Thank you. And again, my name is Richard Graves, Director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research, and I'll share my screen again. So this bill requires a final design approval before projects go into construction. The benefits of this bill are that studies have shown that the earlier you incorporate sustainable design into building projects, that the possibility to have beneficial impacts for sustainability are higher, and the cost and impacts to planning are lower are lower if it's incorporated in the planning stage. So this bill would require projects to check in with us before construction at this phase, when there's still a large possibility to affect their design and keep costs and impacts to the project and schedule low while retaining all the sustainable design benefits. If projects move into construction before kind of verifying their design, that's when costs go up and the ability to affect the design goes down. And just for information purposes, this is a chart which shows the phases of construction for B3 and SB 2030. And our phase titles are pre-design, design, and final design, which, and hence the term final design in the bill, which represents the point where design ends, construction documents are completed, and then construction begins. So it would require projects to get approval of their design in compliance with B3 at the end of construction documents and before construction starts. So thank you, Chair, and thank you, members of the committee.
Representative Raleigh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, one of the things that I'm hearing from constituents and in the business community is the real pressures that are being put onto the business community as far as supply chain of materials, the costs of building materials, the cost of labor. In your projections, can you share with us how these calculations are taking into account the future pressures that we're seeing on the supply chain, and how do the calculations take that into account? Because, you know, I'm seeing that what you're trying to do is look to the future and try to figure out where, you know, the costs and the construction requirements are going to go, specifically from the environmental side, according to the slide. I'm just wondering what kind of calculations on the pressures from workforce augmentation, workforce personnel, and then the material supplies, specifically for the out period of the construction, meaning after, you know, the hammers are swinging and concrete's being poured. Thank you, Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair.
Dr. Graves.
So typical best practice for construction inflation is to incorporate a 5% increase year over year going forward. And to your point, the last couple of years, because of supply chain and labor pressures, you know, it seems like construction inflation has been more of that, more than that. So that's the challenge. As far as sustainable design, you know, the B3 requirements require sort of cost-effective implementation of sustainable design and energy efficiency. And we do a lot of work with the requirements, working with stakeholders in design, construction, and owners of buildings category to make sure as we're rolling out and updating the guidelines that we're having impact for sustainable design, but doing that at the most cost-effective way.
Thank you. Representative Raleigh.
Yeah, thank you. I've read the same thing, that there's a 5% overage built into the calculations. On the same topic, I'm just kind of looking for future-looking statements on this one. Should we look at a different model of projecting what the market is doing to us? Because we're hearing a lot of bills as supplemental requests, and almost all the bills, both here in or in the Labor Industry Vets Committee that I'm hearing and other committees, the supplemental budgets all seem to be surrounding the increased costs of labor and materials. And Madam Chair, what I'm thinking is, you know, should we take a look at changing, you know, the formulas for contingency plans? And specifically, what I'm driving towards is I want to get to the true cost, because as we fund these projects through capital investment, we want to know as a committee what the true costs are going to be. And getting to the real number, I think, is a goal that we all should have. And so I'm just wondering, Doctor, if there's a better formula, or what would be the way that if we don't have a formula, what would be the way that you'd suggest that we get to that formula? Who should we involve in this question? Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. That would be a very helpful answer. Dr. Graves, if you can address that.
I think most of this I'd have to defer to the Department of Administration, but the one thing I would add is that from our experience working with projects, the better job they can do in their pre-design in identifying exactly what site they're going to build on, what the challenges might be with those sites, exactly what their program is, exactly what the construction methodology and technology and systems they're going to use, it sets the stage for a better estimate and a better way to project that going forward. So anything that can kind of get a good pre-design for projects generally will have benefits in getting more better estimates. So.
Thank you very much. I think we have to go now to our second person that's going to testify, Sherry Hansen.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Sherry Hansen. I'm here on behalf of the American Institute of Architects, which represents more than 2,200 design professionals statewide, to offer our support for this bill. AIA Minnesota is a strong supporter of the SB 2030 guidelines overall. Minnesota's public buildings are more resilient, efficient, and cost-effective because of the standard. The Center for Sustainable Building Research, which Richard leads, both supports building projects that use public funding and tracks data on projects as they're completed. It's an invaluable resource in our fight against climate change. Their data in 2021 showed that the state is saving more than $22 million each year due to the design and engineering improvements accomplished through SB 2030. Minnesota architects have learned over the years that not thinking about SB 2030 until later in the design and construction process can result in significant changes to design and budget that set a project back. Time and cost overruns negatively impact the project, the workers employed to build it, the community where it's located, and Minnesota taxpayers if additional dollars are required. Many entities that seek bonding dollars work SB 2030 compliance into their pre-design or early design processes, which helps avoid these problems. But for some communities and entities that do not have as much experience in state-funded projects, knowing the best time and stage of a project to engage with SB 2030 compliance can be a challenge. We appreciate that this bill identifies a specific point in a project timeline which SB 2030 compliance must be addressed. A bright line like this can save significant time and dollars by avoiding a need to rework a design or interrupt a phase of construction. We're also supportive of the bill's provision to require a cost estimator for small projects, or beyond SB 2030 compliance, using an estimator can help projects more accurately plan for and request funding at the right level without needing to come back to the legislature for additional dollars. There will always be things we can't plan for, and we know that no estimate will ever be perfect, but estimators can help cut back on inefficiencies in the same way that well-timed checks on SB 2030 compliance will. Whether for our public or private sector clients, architects are constantly honing our budgeting, estimating, project management, and compliance systems. It's part of our commitment to using development funds as efficiently as possible while still designing a high-performance built environment. We believe that the changes proposed in this bill will help those who receive state funding for their construction projects do better. And as such, we hope you'll support this bill. Thank you.
Ms. Hansen, do you want to address Representative Raleigh's second question?
Can the question be repeated?
Yes, I'm sure he can if he's still here. Representative Raleigh, your second question about...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the second question was, what are we doing as far as looking at the formulas for these cost overruns? In other committees, we're hearing that most of the supplemental requests for funding in 2022 are, and again, this is my personal observation, I'm seeing and observing that almost all of them are asking for supplemental money because of cost overruns related to labor costs and materials costs. And the question was, is there a better formula to more accurately take this into account? And then the second part of it was, who should we involve in that question? Thank you, Madam Chair.
thank you for that question. I think the answers to that are incredibly complex. I think Richard approached some of that, and I would agree that the Department of Administration would be great to have weigh in on this. I think having all the stakeholders at the table that are possible would be great. I think this is something that as the market moves forward and changes, it's really important to be doing checks on that and modernizing it to come along with it. I would also note that the current situation is one we haven't seen for a really long time. And I think there's a lot of factors that have led to the current market. And so I think we have to understand that the likelihood that we're ever going to get to a perfect estimate a couple years before a project is going to dig is pretty low. So we have to do our best. And I think having that deep dive conversation with folks from construction, with folks from labor, with architects and engineers, and everybody who's involved in that, including the state agencies, would be a great first step to getting us toward that. And we do have to acknowledge the incredible pressures that that we're facing right now. I think the agencies, as they are trying to get their buildings constructed and are just seeing things they couldn't have anticipated when they went in for their request, that's a reality. And we're also seeing a lot of pressure on our contractors and on our architects and other folks that are involved in the process. So I know Representative Lee has been working really hard on finding a way to make this more efficient and more effective, and we'll continue to support that work.
And Madam Chair, this is Representative Raleigh. I did have a follow-up to that, if I could.
Quickly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What pressures are we seeing from these campuses not having workers show up? And I'm trying to do it quickly. We're seeing that the socioeconomic way that we used to all show up at a single building, work there, and then go home is changing because of the electronics. And we're hearing bills today to increase technology, to increase connectivity and access to this connectivity. How is that creating additional downward pressures on the need for additional space? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Manson.
Thank you for your question. That is probably not something we can answer in a quick way. I think knowing that we're trying to keep moving, what I would say is the design community is working constantly with their clients to change and adapt based on what's happening with their workforce and their needs within physical space. I know we're seeing, even within the design profession, that office space is being used more now for teamwork and spot drop-in and hoteling than it was for everyone having a desk and being at it every single day. So that is another really big topic that's changing the way we think about our built environment in Minnesota, and should definitely be part of deep discussions going forward. Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Quickly.
And to, I don't know, either Dr. Or Ms. Hansen here. Just so that we understand, is it all buildings receiving public money must receive SB 2030 compliance scrutiny? Is that a correct statement? All businesses or all buildings receiving public money?
Dr. Graves, Ms. Hansen?
It's all projects receiving bond funds.
Okay, thank you. All projects receiving bond funds.
Yeah, I think there are some additional types of projects depending upon the routing of the funds that I'd defer to admin to identify those other types of projects. But in general, it's projects receiving bond funds.
Thank you. Dr. Graves, and I have one more question, Madam Chair, and that is this just new construction, or is it monies for renovation or restoration of buildings?
Representative, it's new construction plus renovations, and also system upgrades. If a project is updating their mechanical system, there are requirements for those as well.
One more thing quickly, Madam Chair and Dr. Graves. Would that also then be required for buildings that have hit for historical renovation?
It is required for historic buildings. However, we work with buildings that are historic buildings to give variances if there's a conflict between the system upgrades and the historic character of the building.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Graves. Thank you, Ms. Hansen, Director Hansen. Chair Lee, I think some good information has been delivered to us, and I strongly advise the agencies that we work with to think about the subject that we just talked about in 4631. And House File 4231, because for sure we're going to be talking about these things as the capital investment bill progresses. Representative Lee, let us go on now at this time for House File 4739.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House File 4739 is establishing a community air monitoring system pilot program. And members, as we have heard from the MPCA and the community and Andover with some of their legacy contaminants around PFAS, I just wanted to bring, you know, an issue that's important for communities like mine in North Minneapolis, where air pollution is a critical issue that we should monitor and address. And so what we're proposing here is to create a pilot program that will provide funding for local air quality monitoring by communities that are impacted by air pollution so that they could actually get out there, collect data, and develop strategies to reduce some of the pollution in their communities. And the detail of the bills, you know, talks about the establishment of the program, what qualifies as the equipment, you know, what are the different eligible uses of the funding, and how the MPCA should go about awarding the process, you know, creating the application and awarding the funds, how they should prioritize funding, and then also requiring a report back to the agency. And Madam Chair, I will turn it over to one of my community members who's here to testify. You know, this is something that I have heard from her ever since I entered the legislature. And, you know, if we're going to address legacy contaminants and communities, you know, across the state, I think that we need to hear about, you know, the importance of air pollution, monitoring air pollution, and what can we do to reduce the response to that that may have major consequences to the health and well-being of Minnesotans like the residents in my district, Madam Chair.
Okay. And you have someone to testify?
Yes, I think Ms. O'Brien is on the call.
Ms. O'Brien.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good day, good people. My name is Roxanne O'Brien. I am the co-founder of Community Members for Environmental Justice. I am a mother and community leader where I live. I'm not paid to be here today. CMEJ is based in North Minneapolis. It's an environmental justice community, a low-income community of color with multiple sources of industrial pollution, generating a legacy of environmental health issues. North Minneapolis includes a heavy industrial zone corridor amongst numerous other industrial facilities, Olson Memorial Highway and Interstate 94. The disproportionate burden of air pollution in this area has been well documented across departments and jurisdictions, including by the Minneapolis Health Department, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, University of Minnesota, Minnesota Department of Health, and the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. I am here in support of House File 4739 to fund a community air monitoring system pilot grant program. Air pollution is a major problem in many areas of the state where industries are concentrated around families. In the Twin Cities, we have had a generational legacy of air pollution that has impacted our parents and now our children. This bill is a step in breaking that cycle. As many news outlets have reported, toxic substances like fine particulate matter, nitrogen dioxide, and ozone form primarily when fossil fuels are burned and enter the atmosphere in the exhaust from motor vehicles, industrial facilities, and other sources. Inhaling such pollutants can cause bodily damage that lasts for years, if not for life, and may even lead to death. A report published in the journal Circulation found that years of breathing low concentrations of pollution affects our elderly. Older people are more likely to suffer a heart attack, stroke, and pneumonia because of air pollution, resulting in thousands of additional hospital admissions each year. Stopping air pollution saves lives today. While there are some stack level monitoring systems in place by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, the community needs better protection. And that starts with a more robust understanding of more local, neighborhood, and street level pollution. The granular level data will provide a more comprehensive picture of air quality and help to address the public health impacts we face due to this pollution. Thank you for being there for our community today, and thank you for supporting this bill.
Thank you, Ms. O'Brien. Are there any questions? If not, we will hold this over for possible inclusion, or hold it over. And we will go on to your next bill, Representative Lee, House File 3780.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. So House File 3780 is to provide appropriations to the Minnesota Management and Budget Agency to provide for staffing to raise awareness about the process and to provide technical assistance about capital budgets to nonprofits, and also for small projects that were governed under the statute that we have discussed earlier, you know, in working with AIA, you know, in trying to figure out, you know, what can we do to support small local projects or nonprofit when they scope their projects so that we have the most accurate assessment of, you know, the cost of these projects. I think that it is needed for us to have staff available from the agencies to provide these expertise about the budgeting process and, you know, compliance requirements with the different stages of the capital project development. Madam Chair, and so this proposal is just doing that, you know, providing staffing support at the agencies for projects that are coming forward from nonprofits and small projects. And I'll turn it over. I believe Ms. Hansen is also here to testify on the bill.
Okay, welcome back, Ms. Hansen.
Thank you so much. Again, my name is Sherry Hansen, and I'm here on behalf of AIA Minnesota. We'd like to voice our support for this bill to provide resources for the state to do outreach and assistance to entities that are using the capital budget process. As it stands now, we have a group of practitioners, agencies, and other public-funded entities that are well-versed in the bonding process and can do it efficiently and consistently. However, we should strive to expand the core group to cities and counties who don't often do bonded projects, and to capable developers and design professionals that just need a better roadmap. To do that, we need to provide targeted resources to support their success as put forth in this bill. We also know that nonprofits, developers, and design professionals from BIPOC and Native communities have not necessarily had the same opportunities to participate in publicly funded projects. This bill provides needed resources to make access to our public process more equitable, a goal the state should focus on. AIA Minnesota believes providing MMB with resources so their staff can rise to meet this challenge is a good use of the modest funds requested. Design professionals do as much as they can to support the development of skills and experience among more of their colleagues, but without structural support, it's difficult to expand the pool of experts and clients that can navigate this well. We appreciate Chair Lee's interest in looking at ways to make the bonding process more efficient, effective, and equitable, like the proposal before you. And we'll ask for your support. Thank you.
Ms. Hansen, you said the modest amount for a project to someone that that applying for a state assistance. Anyway, what is a modest amount?
I believe the reference to the amount is the appropriation to MMB to help them staff up correctly, rather than it being a direct ask from the developer, if I understand the structure of the bill correctly.
Okay. Representative Lee, you have a fiscal note in the materials that were for House File 3780. Do you want to comment on the fiscal note?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, for that. So the fiscal note that we have received from MMB will require three staff positions over at MMB for their two budget divisions, and the cost in fiscal year 23 will be $464,000, and then fiscal year the next biennium, the 24-25 biennium, the tails will be $928,000 for the three staff.
But if this staff, if this House Files 3780 would be included in this, that would significantly help the people that are coming to ask for help, would it not?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you for that. So this will increase, you know, MMB's ability to proactively reach out to provide, you know, support around, you know, the capital budget system for, like I said, nonprofits and all those and those small projects from local units of government that may not traditionally engage in the bonding process. And so this is to help out all entities that are interested in, you know, receiving state fund. And so this is just to, you know, provide that capacity for them.
Very good. Representative Verdal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a brief comment. You know, I think that it's not a bad idea to streamline or make more efficient or more accessible the ability to deal with the bonding situation and make applications. But that said, I do think that a lot of people seem to have figured it out, because we have $5 to $6 billion in requests this year. So it's not that folks can't figure out how to do this. Thank you.
Quite well taken. Is there any other discussion on House File 3780? If not, thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Hansen, again. And Chair Lee, we will go on to House File 3145.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And House File 3145, you know, is my proposal to really look at the, you know, our conversation around the 50% match, as we all have seen or heard in committee. And on tours, you know, members are coming forward with proposals to not require the 50% match that's required under 16A86 subdivision 4. And so what I'm trying to do here is that we're amending the statute requiring non-state commitments to capital projects by adding that the state share of a capital project for political subdivision is intended to be no more than 50% of the cost. And that we also require for the information that are provided to the state for all of us as we go through, you know, the process, that projects let us know, you know, the funding that is necessary to complete the capital project or project phase that they have secured for non-state funding, so that we have that information available for us when we're making the decision on how and, you know, at what amount do we fund these projects that are coming forth. And then the bill's repeals section 16A86 subdivision 4, which is the current requirement for the 50% match. And that's the entirety of the bill.
50%. You have an A1 amendment?
Yep, so yeah, so the A1 amendment is just to, you know, we have heard from the MAC Council about how this potentially impact them. And so just to exempt them from this, since they do work with, they are considered a, you know, political subdivision, and they do work with local communities here in the Seminole County metro area. And And so we just wanted to make sure that they are not considered a political subdivision here and that they actually, you know, do the work and providing support for the local communities in the Seven Council metro area. And so that's why the A1 amendment is there.
Thank you for that clarification. And in this case, the Metropolitan Council wouldn't be a political subdivision.
Right, for the purpose of this bill, Madam Chair.
Yes. And what happens when someone then, what if we put this into effect and then the next project that comes in, they say, oh, we can't possibly get 50%. Then what do we do?
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the question. You know, that's up to the legislature. And if we do determine that a project is something that we should consider funding for, and they have, you know, demonstrated that they can't, we can waive this match. But I think that that's a case by case basis. And so just wanted to make sure that we have this in law saying that, you know, as currently right now in 16886 subdivision 4, that, you know, we do require a 50% match. And if the legislature shall choose, they could waive that.
Yes. I think that we should consider this very strongly because, as I've seen more and more, as Representative Erdahl mentioned, a lot of people have figured out how to approach MMB and fill out their application forms if they're going through the process. Between all those new bills that had came in, and then all the new bills that came in late, much later than MMB deadline, we had significantly more bills to consider or projects to consider. And then, in addition to all that new stuff, we also had a lot of bills that said no need to have a matching fund on behalf of the local community. And I think they're coming to the state to ask for help with things, projects that are absolutely necessary to a particular area at this particular time. And so we should consider that it is a help. 50% of the project is definitely a help. And so we can't say or can't accept the idea that a project is shovel ready when there's no local match at all. That's kind of my opinion, people, in the sense that I think we should strongly consider House File 3145. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Lee. It's already been discussed that right now with 50% match, we do have a discretion. We can have less than 50%. We can determine some other amount. And, you know, we use that quite often. But again, I think 50% is a good target. However, my concern here is that with the Met Council being basically exempted from having to do this, what is happening is that Greater Minnesota projects will be mandated to do the 50% match, but not the Met Council projects. That would be a major concern of mine.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, you know, feedback, Representative Erdahl. You know, in reaching out to the MMB, they do consider the Met Council as part of the governor's cabinet. And so in my opinion, you know, we don't really need this, but just to ensure to the Met Council that, you know, they are considered as a part of the cabinet and as a state agency and, you know, providing the the funds that they are doing, that they're not required as a council to provide that 50% match, that whoever, you know, they're going to provide funding for, you know, if they were to do provide funding for to the city of Minneapolis for any of the programs that does require 50% match, it's not the Met Council, but it's actually the city of Minneapolis that I represent that has to make that match. And so just to clarify that piece, that it's not the Met Council responsibility, but it's those cities or those local units of government within the Met Council's jurisdiction that has to provide that 50% match. And so we're not exempting any cities, you know, in the Seven Council metro area or within the Met Council jurisdiction. It's just the state, the Met Council as an agencies in this perspective. And so just want to make that clear for the record, Madam Chair.
Good clarification. Is there any further discussion on House File 3145? If not, Chair Lee, do you have any other bills to bring before us this morning?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have any other bills before us today. And then, Madam Chair, I'll take over the virtual gavel back for a brief announcement before we adjourn. Really want to say thank you to all of our members. And as you may have noticed, the hearing for tomorrow has been canceled. And as you, I just want to let you all know and members of the public know that there are, you know, discussions right now at the leadership levels that, you know, Representative Erdahl and myself are hoping for so that we could get some more direction on how do we move forward a proposal. Really appreciate the feedback that we have heard from Representative Erdahl on making sure that we have a proposal that reflect the entire committee. And so that's what we're trying to do here. And a member, again, thank you all so very much. This is the 49th hearing for all of us here in the House Capital Investment Committee. And, you know, just want to make sure that you are aware that as we go forward, all meetings will be called at the call of the chair. And so please look for any hearing notifications from our committee administrator. Without any more business in front of us, this meeting is adjourned.